This is Mae Brussel. It is tape number 850, March the 21st, 1988. There was a double slaying in California. Those of you on the East Coast might not have read about it, or overseas, of course, you wouldn't. Millionaire motorsports promoter Mickey Thompson and his wife Trudy Thompson were ambushed and shot to death in the driveway of their hillside estate in Bradbury, California, 3 days after he told a friend he had received several death threats and feared for his life. This double homicide was described in the San Jose Mercury as an assassination, and the details of that murder are not too important to this case, except to say that when I got the death threat of this person that caused me to believe he meant it when I shouldn't be on the radio, a lot of friends, well-meaning people, tried to say, well, that was first a lone nut, and secondly, people don't do those things who threaten to do them. Of course, most of us know better than that. There are a lot of people that threaten to kill and do kill, haunt and kill, and I just bring it up because he was telling people that he was receiving death threats and was afraid for his life. The motives were different there than in the case of the threat that I got, but the point is the mindset of people who threaten and carry it out is just as firm in most cases as people who say they want to commit suicide and then do that. So I just want to illustrate an example of what happened this week and say why I take the threat seriously. There are several books out, three books that are out, a lot of them coming, and I want to give you the titles and the authors so that they don't slip away from you. They're new, and right now when they're new, we think we can always get them, and pretty soon they're not on the stand. Some of them aren't. One is Citizen Cone by Nicholas von Hoffman, published by Doubleday. The person who wrote it, Nicholas von Hoffman, was on Larry King's program, and he was detailing, and I'm sure it's in the book, his Roy Cohn's intense hatred for Robert Kennedy. He hated Robert Kennedy. There was a battle going between the two of them constantly. Of course, Robert Kennedy was trying to get rid of organized crime, or said he was, in this country, making a start at it, and Roy Cohn's friends and clients were high up in the organized crime group. If you read the Torbett document, and many of you have it, you'll read the role of Lionel Train Company and Roy Cohn representing Lionel. They not only made toy trains for little people, but they worked for the Defense Department. And the Torbett document goes into the relationship of Roy Cohn to the murder of John Kennedy, and then, of course, shortly afterwards was the murder of Robert Kennedy. I've had several requests for information on how to get videotapes. I may have had this on the air. I think I have before. I'm going to give it to you one more time and maybe update it from time to time. There's a place called Fusion Video, and it's a toll-free number, 1-800-338-7710. 24-hour toll-free. And they have videos such as Mein Kampf, Inside the Company, Philip Agee's account of CIA subversion, three-part series of Pure Blood, which is a very, very important movie to own. To see what is happening now, you have to really visualize that and hear the explanations of the experiments of breeding children for the 1,000-year Reich. At least 100,000 of them are wandering around now, are in the ages of 40 to 45. They also have McCarthy, The Death of a Witch Hunter, The Spanish Civil War, and The Confessions of Bernhard Goetz. So call Fusion Video. They're located in Illinois. Toll free, 1-800-338-7710. They also have Mein Kampf, a visual demonstration of how Hitler came to power. Another book that was reported in New Yorker and is now out is called Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors by Herbert Mietang, published by Donald Fine. It's 1895, an important book on how the literature was affected by Senator Joe McCarthy and his group. They also affected Hollywood and the art forms and kept us literally an ignorant country unless we sought out for ourselves the writers who were doing material but weren't publicized or who were blacklisted. And I think that's where I learned to catch on to the foreign films as being so authentic, because Hollywood was screening out the legitimate people who could make decent films. Another book that just came out is Waldheim, The Missing Years by Robert Erdwin Herzstein, H-E-R-Z-S-T-E-I-N. This is a history book club selection. It just came out about the role that Waldheim played during the years of the war, that he kept quiet and suppressed his activities and lied about them, actually lied about them. The San Francisco Chronicle this morning got a hold of a report of the Presidio Child Care Center that was suppressed and not released. The man who wrote the report was Colonel William J. Schaefer. The persons who wrote in the Chronicle got the report under Freedom of Information Act, and of course all charges were dropped against the molestation of at least 60 children at the Presidio. The Chronicle says when the molestation scandal erupted recently, the daycare center facility was understaffed, screened employees badly, kept sloppy records, and this report goes into recommendations of now putting a closed-circuit camera system and at a minimum one-way mirrors to prevent abuse of children in the future. This report, or at least parts of it, doesn't even say they were taken off the grounds to the location apartment of Michael Aquino and possibly other people. The report says there was insufficient child care staff, incomplete children's records of medical problems or indications of problems, incomplete staff records of the care workers, the training centers, and nothing about past histories, of course, of child molestation and other problems there. Sloppy background investigations of adult staff members, and three of the center's top administrators resigned after the scandal, and now they've been transferred to another place, and I wonder if when they're transferred, there's records of their past that caused them to leave San Francisco Presidio Nursery School in the first place. The report said there's an unsafe physical plant at the Presidio with what they call dead spots in which children or adults could hide from the child care staffers. It was in these inaccessible areas that some of the incidents of molestation allegedly took place. Gary Hambright was charged with committing lewd acts, oral copulation with children. In his care, he was indicted in late 1986. The case is still being investigated by the FBI, but the San Francisco District Attorney dropped the charges. And shockingly, this report was not given. I guess when the charges were dropped, the report was suppressed. So when the charges were dropped about a month ago, now we find out that there is a report. And one lady said, on no occasion was my daughter where she was supposed to be when I came to pick her up. Frequently, gates to the playground were unlocked. Anyone was allowed to enter. The staff also, according to the report, had employees who couldn't speak, write, or read the English language, and they were in charge of these children. So that is a report obtained by Freedom of Information that evidently was not used when the charges were dropped. Now, the indictments of the Big Four with the Iran-Contra affair are very interesting, and much could be said about them at the present time. I won't go into a lot of material that was available in the newspapers and the wire services this week, but the Bob Woodward story in the Washington Post is particularly interesting because I have mentioned on World Watchers before that Ollie North had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court because he wouldn't turn over a signature of his hand, a copy of his handwriting, even though he's under the salary of the U.S. government at the present time, and all you'd have to do is walk up and say, sign this paper, and I'm sure he is writing or signing letters and things on the material he's working on now. It can't be all computers, I don't believe. And if it is, you just say, sign this. Well, I believe that the big scandal could possibly be that he was forging the name of the President of the United States. And this story kind of hints that that's the way it's going, and that would be a real shocker. This is about North's ransom courier who carried presidential authorization letter. As part of a secret 1986 plan to ransom hostages, Colonel North sent a private businessman who worked for H. Ross Perot with $100,000 in cash. And many of you heard that story this week. And he had a letter from the National Security Council for his bona fides. And in Montreal, the courier who worked for Perot handed the money over to a Canadian citizen of Armenian descent, and the purpose, allegedly, was to release Peter Kilbourne. Now, that $100,000 that was provided was a down payment for $1 million more, and 3 months later, Kilbourne was turned over to Libyan terrorists and killed in retaliation for the U.S. bombing. Now, the big story here is that new questions came up, Bob Woodward wrote, about the Iran-Contra investigation. And right from the beginning, what authority did North have to make these kind of clandestine operations? North repeatedly said he had express authority from his superiors and the president's national security advisors as he tried to implement Reagan's policy. And he mentioned when he said he was going to resign this week that he might have to call in the president of the United States. And the White House said that Reagan had no knowledge of efforts to ransom the hostages. And so in the face of this, North was using the Drug Enforcement Agency, Ross Perot's money. He said it was personally approved by the president, but there's no finding and no indication at all that the president knew it unless North had forged his signature on those papers. Now, at the time all this was going on, North worked in the National Security Council with FBI agent Oliver Buck Revel. God, turned around. His name is always confusing to me. FBI Executive Assistant Oliver Buck Revel. And Revel worked with North on, in quotes, terrorism. Now, at the time of the Berlin Disco bombing, they were blaming Gaddafi, this team in the National Security Council, and Reagan was on way to the summit in Japan, the financial summit, and all, he took away all the news of the financial deficit and the budget and the international monetary problems to talk about Gaddafi. And then all of a sudden, the charges of Gaddafi being responsible for the Disco bombing in Berlin were the reason for us to bomb Libya, and our allies wouldn't go along with us. They didn't believe it. Only Margaret Thatcher would let the airplanes leave from England. And later it turned out that a Syrian was involved, several Syrians were involved, and not Gaddafi at all. Now, this money went to a man in Damascus. The CIA has traced the money, and he spent it on high living. And so the money, over $100,000 with a guarantee of $1 million, went to Syria, and Syria was the country that was involved with the bombing. And I believe that we set up that bombing so we could bomb Libya. Ali North would look strong. They'd look like they were tough on terrorism. I believed all along it was an agent provocateur action. And, of course, the president wouldn't sign his name to that. And the courier delivered the man money to a man who the CIA knew and saw spending it, not for the purposes that it was supposed to be spent for. And the San Francisco Examiner, as part of the article, said, from the Washington Post, quoting, that FBI Director William Webster, now CIA Director, approved that the FBI participate in the plan also. The newspaper said the plan was discussed with Edwin Meese. And North said he had the authority from his superiors, but the White House said Reagan had absolutely no knowledge. And as I say, he would have to sign a finding. So it's very possible now that what North was doing was forging the president's signature onto something, but it was a covert operation, worse than covert, a agent provocateur operation that was excuse to bomb Libya, which the president wanted to do, but setting it up by paying a Syrian, and that this money was not to get Kilburn. As soon as we bombed Libya, Mr. Kilburn was murdered. There was no reason for him to be murdered. He was turned over to people in the Middle East and murdered. So the money not only didn't save him, but it went to a Syrian that the CIA knew about, and the FBI director, who's our CIA director, was in on it, and that's probably why Mr. Webster, one of 1,000 reasons why he was promoted to be the CIA director. Another story out of the San Jose Mercury Wire Service this week that's interesting, Walsh is widening the probe of scandal. Now that he's indicted the Core Four, he's broadened his inquiry into other people. He's consulted Willard Zucker, the man that Arthur Lyman said he wanted to speak to and couldn't. Well, Arthur Lyman represents Robert Vesco as attorney, and so does Willard Zucker as his financier. So Lyman didn't really try very hard. But Zucker has assisted Lawrence Walsh with unraveling some of the money, and one of the people they're focusing now on is Thomas Kleins, the retired CIA covert operation expert, and Albert Hakim. And, of course, Kleins and Theodore Shackley were instrumental with the CIA in overthrowing Allende and having Pinochet into power, this fascist in power in Chile. They were involved with drug traffic and Phoenix program in Southeast Asia. And now the special prosecutor is going after Mr. Thomas Kleins. The article from the Mercury, March 17, said it is generally acknowledged that if the outgoing president were to forgive the indicted men before the election, there would be grave political consequences for the Republican Party and for George Bush. The risks are far less after the election. Now, there'll be all kinds of manipulation in an election year, but once Oliver North resigns from the military and said, I can't be in uniform while I subpoena and ask the highest, which would be Ronald Reagan. Once he named Ronald Reagan, the pardon would look like, I'm pardoning you so you wouldn't have to go to trial and name me. So Reagan really gets between a rock and a hard place right now. And another article of interest this week was about Walsh's thorough, relentless pursuit is bearing real fruit, and it said he could ultimately reveal how a covert operation run by the White House ran afoul of the constitutional trust between the government and the government. And that is an area that, of course, I've worked on for years and said it isn't the CIA, it's the National Security Council and National Security Agency that run our country. It is a constitutional problem, a constitutional trust that has been broken for many, many years, actually since the National Security Council was formed. And then another article from the San Francisco Examiner that was interesting. When the case hits the court, it's an entirely different ballgame. And it said there will be no stalling, grandstanding, standing, flag waving that characterized the hearings before. In the trial, they have to answer serious questions. It will be right on the evidence that Oliver North will never be allowed to launch into meandering emotional speeches and lectures that converted him into a folk hero for the moment. And another large article in the Los Angeles Times, unlike Watergate, legal case is unprecedented. And it said Tuesday's 23-count indictment poses a series of legal difficulties without precedent. The jury will have to grasp the details of a huge, complex, alleged conspiracy. They'll have to grapple with the fundamental issues of public policy, accountability, control, responsibility for actions of military officials and government bureaucrats. And this article goes on that Watergate was fairly conventional, and it was simple, breaking and entering and overlying the obstruction of justice. But this, in contrast, deals with abstruse issues, the fundamental question that the public has been asking and should have asked since the National Security Council was formed, when the scandal broke, whether the executive branch of the government has the right under U.S. law and Constitution to conduct covert foreign policy in defiance of Congress, to present deceptive accounts of their actions to Congress, to operate here and abroad only by the general authorization and not the specific of the President of the United States. And this article continues, within hours of the indictment, one defendant was making a statement, this is Ollie North, I've now been caught in a dispute between Congress and the President over the control of foreign policy. Does the President ever have to account to Congress what they are doing? Remember, we have a general in the National Security as the chief advisor now, and the military has been running the NSC since World War II. Can they do anything they want? We elect the congressman. We elect the president. The president doesn't know what's going on half the time. And the NSC, a team of 20, 30, 40 military, make the decisions and lie to over 500 people sitting in the halls of Congress, lied in their press reports and news releases that they have daily, even lied to the president so he doesn't know what they're doing. This case has tremendous implications. And then this article is written by David Lauder, said the case squarely confronts a more central and political explosive issue, whether North and Poindexter did was authorized by President Reagan. And that goes back into the handwriting, and if a signature was there and it wasn't the president's, I don't think Ollie North is going to be a hero very long. And, of course, this article goes into the diversion of money that the U.S. government, the case goes in, gave a certain amount, a budget for weapons. They were paid back. But in the diversion, the defendants deceitfully exploited for their own purpose and corrupted a United States government initiative. They deprived the government of honest and faithful services of employees, free of conflict of interest, corruption, or self-dealing. And in this case, Lawrence Walsh has gone around the Boland Amendment. It isn't a question of when Congress says you can't arm the Contras, can you get it from other sources? He's avoiding the issue of the Boland Amendment entirely and saying when these people had the intention to arm the Contras and they're in private business, they sent them pennies while they accrued millions of dollars, 14 or 16 million, and at least seven in their names at Merrill Lynch in London for themselves when the Contras needed material. If there's accountability and it goes through what Lawrence Walsh calls honest and faithful employees who are free from conflicts, such as Oliver North, whose indictment is named as receiving an offer for college education for his four children or security for the family. If you use the faithful services employees free from conflicts, corruption, and self-dealing, where does the money go when there's no accountability and the enterprise thought that they could use it as they saw fit to buy land in Washington State, an ammunition factory, or making weapons in Utah and going into private business with the profit and skirting the accountability? So this is going to be a very, very interesting case, and of course I'll be doing a lot more on it. The Wall Street Journal this morning has a story, only Jesse Jackson is making drugs a major issue. This is one that could dog George Bush during most of the election, and it goes into the fact that George Bush was in charge of the South Florida Task Force, which we know, and now the Wall Street Journal, that very conservative paper, said, how could Bush, spearheading an anti-drug program, not know that Panama strongman General Manuel Antonio Noriega was suspected for years of being a drug trafficker? Well, he's on the CIA payroll, and of course you have the double whammy, because Bush was the director of the CIA and worked with Noriega. The drugs were a common issue, and only Jesse Jackson is making the drugs an issue. And speaking of drugs, I have to update a program I did January the 11th, 2 months already, program 840, and it was about the Health Maintenance Organization, Miami Herald story, December the 20th, about Mr. Mike Riccieri Jr. Miguel Riccieri is his real name, Jr., who came to the United States and formed a company and had Jeb Bush, the son of the vice president, lobbying for this company to make the largest amount of Medicare payments of any company in the United States. And then they got involved with criminal indictments. And Lynn Nofziger, White House advisor, Reagan advisor, made $400,000 off the case. John Sears made $300,000 off the case. And Paula Hawkins was pushing for IMC's funding and growth out of the her health and human resources. She's now our ambassador to Ireland. And so I did a broadcast. If you don't have it, you really should get that one. People, new listeners who don't have tape 840, you should have all of them because I refer to them frequently. And one of the key points about this HMO Health Maintenance Organization was that it was set up by the notorious drug dealers Robert Vesco and Santos Traficanta. And Jeb Bush was a very important part of this operation that was founded and put together with money for Riccieri from organized crime. Now, to follow that up, there's a long article in the Miami Herald by Lisa Getter, at March the 4th, 1988, and it isn't making the wire services, of course. Across the front of the Herald, Jeb Bush's firm got $75,000 from IMC. $75,000. He stood to make over $1 million and immediate $250,000. And the gist of the article was at the time that Mr. Riccieri was trying to get federal money for his medical foundation group, Miguel Riccieri, Jeb Bush was using his authority to call Washington, and he stood to make profits from the deal. The articles, this is the son of the vice president of the United States. Jeb Bush called a federal regulator on behalf of the controversial International Medical Center, IMC, and I had that before, where he stood to gain $250,000 in a real estate deal. Now, the sworn congressional testimony is being released of the subcommittee on government operations, the subcommittee on intergovernment relations and human resources. The hearings on this matter took place in December, and now they're just coming out as George Bush is running for president of the United States, It said, according to the sworn testimony in the congressional hearings, he tried to steer millions of federal dollars to IMC. The company collapsed. It was charged with fraud, bribery, political influence peddling, and they even paid George Bush a lot of money when he was running for the Republican position in the last elections. IMC paid heavily to the Republicans, and Jeb Bush was calling because he had a real estate firm that he was running. He's now working as Florida Secretary of Commerce. He had a real estate firm, and he was trying to get a deal where IMC would buy $12 million real estate. This deal Bush was pushing, Jeb Bush, for IMC. It never materialized because the company went bankrupt, but he would have received at least a $250,000 real estate commission off the right off the record. Now, if it's a $12 million real estate deal and he's involved with a company, you know it would be more than $250,000, but they paid him $75,000, the records show. And the Miami Herald has a picture of three checks for $25,000 each paid to Bush Realty. And Bush Realty is trying to get the government to give Mike Ricciari a hunk of money so he can buy real estate from the vice president's son. The article says Bush's work sought a new IMC corporate headquarters, and it took federal and state scrutiny to investigate this property. And while they were investigating the largest health maintenance organization in Florida, the company collapsed. And as I say, it was put together by the people such as Santos Trafficana, who died when the Iran-Contra story began to be unfolding. And when the scandal was unfolding was the time Trafficana died, and Robert Vesco was still alive. And a grand jury indicted Ricciari and his brother and two other members in an elaborate scheme. Now, Ricciari has gone off with a large debt that he owes, money that hasn't been paid so far, millions of dollars, about $41 million. He flipped off somewhere and is hiding. And his co-workers just got prosecuted. The Miami Herald had a story February 27th. Three get prison term in IMC bribe scandal. A federal judge sentenced three white-collar criminals of the International Medical Center's bribery scandal. Men who are community leaders, and the attorney pleaded for them for Jorge Ricciari, the brother of fugitive Mike Ricciari. Mike goes off, and the attorney said, these are hard workers, they're war heroes, they're family men. And the judge said that this is a crime, that hundreds of thousands of people had been hurt, that they were ordered to 3 years to minimum security prison, that's the golf course type of prison, where they can stay free until they appeal it. But the chief kingpin of all this has skipped the country with his money, and his brother and two of his employees are going to prison. And Jeb Bush is very involved in this. It's a long article that said that he wrote persons in Washington and pleaded for them to get money for IMC. He didn't disclose the deal to the regulators when he phoned on the behalf of IMC, that he was selling the real estate land that they would use when they got the money. And Mr. Haddow, I mentioned him before, another broadcast, C. McLean Haddow, a former Health and Human Services chief of staff, became an IMC consultant in 1986. When they got a hunk of money because of Jeb Bush's calling, he left the federal agency and went to work in 1986, and he testified that Jeb Bush called him at Margaret Heckler's request after Bush phoned her about the waiver, a technical waiver that would allow them to have the money they wanted. He testified that he noted the phone call in his daily logs. Haddow destroyed a letter he had written when he denied the waiver and then sent one approving it when he got a call from Jeb Bush. At the time Bush made the calls, he was chairman of the Dade Republican Party. He said he was acting as he would for any constituent in Florida. He never mentioned any personal financial interest to Mr. Mole in the department in Washington either. Ricciari, according to this story, is a heavy political contributor to the state and national election with a penchant for turning his political ties into business. And that is the story of Jeb Bush, IMC, and remember the company was started by the international drug traffickers to begin with. So George Bush has a lot of counting if people would get off their butts and make this available to public officials. Not everyone reads or takes the Miami Herald, so this is something to think about. You may want the last broadcast I did to accompany this one and get some letters and call attention to talk shows. I'll take a break now. We turn off the tape, turn it over. It's a 30-minute tape, 30 minutes on each side. And I'll continue with you in about 1 second.